Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Welcome to Breaking Math, the podcast that explores the fascinating ways mathematics shapes our world. I'm your host, Autumn FNAF, and today we're diving into the intriguing question and book, Do Plants Know Math? Joining me are two incredible guests who are here to shed light on the remarkable mathematical patterns found in nature. Christophe Collet is a mathematician and professor at Smith College, whose work focuses on the geometry and structures in the natural world, from spirals and seashells to the arrangement of leaves. He's passionate about revealing how math alongside biology intersect in fascinating ways. Alongside him is Nancy Pick, a talented science writer and former reporter for the Baltimore Evening Sun. Her first book, The Rarest of Rare, was named one of the best science books of the year by Discover magazine. Nancy has a gift for making complex scientific ideas accessible and engaging. Together with Christophe and two other authors, she brings the hidden mathematics of plants to life in their thought-provoking book. In today's episode, we'll explore the mathematical wonders that govern the plant kingdom, from Fibonacci sequence in sunflower seeds to the intricate geometry of broccoli. Stick with us as we uncover the deep-rooted math in the natural world and ask the question, can plants really... separately from here? So I took your bios and I just made that. It's a pleasure to have both of you on the show. Now, tell us a little bit about yourselves. You have very colorful backgrounds. And how did you two meet as co-authors?
So I'll start. I fell into math a little bit by accident as a way to not do engineering. I was finishing high school in Algeria, where my father was a geologist. And came back to Paris and did an engineering preparation school. And I was bad at computing integrals, but I was good at topology. And so that felt like, okay. And I like literature. All my classmates were, you know, engineering, very tech oriented. And so I thought, oh, math is a little bit more poetic, you know. So I switched to math and I ended up coming to the States to do my PhD. My mother was American, and so I needed to come to this country to keep my citizenship, and ended up studying dynamical systems, chaos theory, and this kind of stuff, symplectic topology. And I was teaching at some point at UC Santa Cruz, and a graduate student of mine did a project on the Mandelbrot set and phyllotaxis. And I thought this was totally wild. And, but it was actually not so wild. And I ended up working with him and switched to biomath and plant math. And the rest is history. And how we met, Nancy and I, we met at a party at a common friend who's a pretty famous artist. And And we started talking about what we were doing. And Nancy told me about her writing books, and in particular, a book about the Museum of Natural History at Harvard. And I told her about my work. And I don't know who said what when, but within half an hour of knowing one another, we said, oh, we have to write a book together. And so there we go. And then we brought in friends and colleagues that I had been working with, a physicist and a biologist. So this is a short story about how we got there.
Yeah, and on my end, I started out as a newspaper journalist, but eventually morphed into writing books. And they were always about history and science, but with all kinds of different angles. So my first book, as Krish mentioned, was called The Rarest of the Rare, and that was about the incredible natural history collections at Harvard. And then over the years, I've also written a book about dinosaur tracks and another related to my family history, which led to me co-producing an off-Broadway play about a mother murdered by her own son. And most recently, I translated a French nonfiction book that was written by a woman obsessed with her ancestor, a man who survived a 19th century shipwreck by turning to cannibalism. So you can see I'm drawn to all kinds of good stories, but of course, plant spirals are really the most compelling story of all. And yeah, as Krish said, we were at a party given by a mutual friend, and I was really drawn into the botanical world by the glass flowers collection at Harvard, and I wanted to write a book about plants, but my agent didn't like any of my pitches. And then when I was talking to Krish, he had this incredible idea based on his research into plant spirals and the Fibonacci sequence. And I remembered that from junior high school when we were shown like a film strip, and it always stuck in my head how cool it was to look at the Fibonacci spiral in plants. And I also remembered the movie Fantasia, of all things. And I thought, oh yes, this is going to make a great book. Plus, I have to say, I was a French major in college, so I'm always looking to use my French whenever I can. And we were off and running, and that was 14 years ago. It was a complicated project, and it did take us a little while to get the book written.
I mean, that happens a lot. So it's been a while since I've used my French, so don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. All of the years of French private Catholic school. Oh. So I completely understand. Now, tell me a little more about who's the audience. I noticed that there are some really cool lessons in the book. Was it difficult to communicate the world of plant spirals to a more of a general audience?
So I would say, Do Plants Know Math? The title of our book. It belongs to a genre known as crossover books, which is to say they're trying to appeal both to a general audience and to a more specialized one like you, Autumn, at the same time. So given my background in journalism, I was determined to make this book readable by non-scientists like me. And the rule was I had to be able to understand everything we put in the book. And we stuck to that, except maybe for the part about dynamical stability, given that physics is really, truly difficult to put into words. And I might be a little shaky on hyperbolic geometry, but that material appears in the appendix at the back of the book, which is where we put the more technical stuff. And the Nancy has to understand rule did not apply to what went into the appendix.
And she was a great enforcer. She was very gracious about it, but very firm at the same time. You know, we got a lot of rejects, but in retrospect, you know, we felt, yes, she was right. So Nancy was very instrumental in being our guide of how you can be understandable by a general audience.
I think you folks have a level up, especially having Nancy on the team. You know, dynamical systems can be difficult at times. I know that. It's one of my favorite topics outside of here and topology, but it's really well written for the general audience. Now, How did you really become interested in the intersection of mathematics and plants? Each of you have your own story, but I know that you brought a lot of these topics together. Within maybe 30 minutes of chatting, what was the real inspiration for that?
Well, I think I've already touched on the story of my graduate student, Scott Hutton, who did this project in Santa Cruz in my graduate seminar. And, again, it was for those in mathematics, the Mandelbrot set is related to what is called complex quadratic maps of the form Z goes to Z squared plus C. And so if you iterate this map on the complex number C, you get spirals. And those spirals, you can count them. And so he classified those spirals within the Mandelbrot set. And this was totally parallel to work that people had done about plant spirals in biology. So there was an interesting parallel there. And then he started looking at models of how those spirals are formed in plants. And then it became his thesis. I became his unofficical thesis advisor. And then I moved to Smith and we got him a postdoc at Harvard with our co-author Jacques Dumay. And so this is how I got into it. But at the very beginning, it was very mathematical. And the more I go, the more I put my hands into dirt. I still kill a lot of plants, but I worked with students. We analyzed data and all that, and so it's been fun to go from a theoretical mathematician to an applied mathematician in that way.
Don't they tell you not to mix theory and application usually?
I love to do both, I still write papers with theorems and I write papers without theorems and simulations, computer simulations and data. And I love the possibility of going between all of these, right?
Yes.
And people, and it's, what's fun also is that people like Alan Turing spend the last 2 years of his life working on this subject. So it's fun to also connect with different people in history in that fashion.
Now, tell us a little bit about the history of plant math. When was it discovered?
Yeah, so, like any field, it's very hard to say, okay, it was that day, right? But we could go all the way back to Leonardo da Vinci, who in one of his notebooks, saying, here are four ways that plants arrange their leaves around their stems, and then he goes in the first way, the leaves go opposed to one another in the second and the third. And in the fourth, he scratches it out. So my daughter and I tried to decipher that, and we had a lot of fun decoding Da Vinci and so we have a hypothesis. But his classification is very simple and but it's remarkable because it came 200 or 300 years before anybody else noticed that, because of course nobody read his notebooks.
Let me just add that in the book we have a facsimile of Da Vinci's notebook so that you too can try to decipher the mysterious fourth mode.
And one time that really marks to me the beginning of the interaction between mathematicians and biologists is in 1754, at least that's the date of publication, of two Swiss scientists, a naturalist Bonnet and a mathematician Calandrini. So for instance, they did a classification of plant patterns that were much more solid than Da Vinci. And Bonnet's study on the plant, the leaves, led to discovering that the leaves breathe. And that in itself also led to photosynthesis.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
The discovery of photosynthesis by other people. So it is really an interesting point of departure for the collaboration between mathematicians and biologists. But the really heavily mathematical biology collaboration really happened in the 1830s by two teams of a team of young German researchers, two young researchers, Schimper and Brown, that came up with the word phyllotaxis, for one, and systematically studied spirals in plants, systematically discovered that plants displayed the Fibonacci sequence in their number of spirals. And at the same time, independently, weirdly, a team of two French brothers, the Bravais brothers, who did a beautiful paper that was quite mathematical with proofs hidden in there. It was really written in a proof language, but it was for botanists. So it was a beautifully written paper that proved the relationship between the number of spirals and the angle between the successive leaves in a plant. And so this is really the beginning, I would say, of plant math and mathematical biology, by the way, right? There's no other, that I know, there's no other genesis story of mathematical biology other than this, right? And then, of course, there was many, many other collaborations between the two sciences that occurred later in that century.
Wonderful. Now, can you tell us a little bit more about some of the common mathematical patterns that we see in plants? Maybe we can dive into that.
Sure. So, botanists look at patterns a little bit differently than mathematicians would do. For a mathematician, it would be just spirals and spiral lattices. But for botanists, they will make a difference between, say, a grass where you would have a leaf on one side and another one going at 180 degrees opposite to it, but up a level and then again and again. So that's one possibility. But you could see that as a spiral or a helix going at 180 degrees angle while it goes up. You have something that's called whorled phyllotaxis, where leaves grow all at the same level in groups of two, three, four. And then the next level, you have again three, four leaves at an angle that is right in between the former leaves, the node that's right below, and so on and so forth. But then there's the famous spiral phyllotaxis, which is really the one that interests us. And that's when you take a leaf and then you turn a certain angle called the divergence angle, and you go up the stem. And then again, the same angle, the same pitch. So in other words, you follow a helix and you put a leaf at a given angle, right? So that's the how should I say, that's the theoretical model, right? But this is not how the plant thinks, right? This is not the way plants think. They don't say, oh, I'm going to make a helix and I'm going to follow that angle precisely. But those, once you do a helix like this, and if you compress that helix, the points that are closer to one another form other helices, and those are the spirals that we see in plants. So if you think about a pineapple, for instance, its scales form rows, and the rows go as helices go in two directions, and usually you have 13 rows going in one direction and 8 going in the other. And so this is the spiral phyllotaxis, right? You can see also versions of that flat in flowers and inflorescences like daisies or even the bottom of a pine cone. You can see the you know, a flat version of those spirals. And sometimes those spirals are logarithmic. And sometimes they go more as a square root of the angle. So these are the patterns that we see in nature. And again, what's remarkable is the fact that the number of spirals is very, very often successive numbers in the Fibonacci sequence. So for those who don't remember the Fibonacci sequence, you start with 1, 1, you add them, you get 2, you add 1 and 2, you get 3, you add the 2 last one, 2 and 3, you get 5, and so on. So it's a recurring pattern. So I can go on a little bit more about why this pattern, but I'll let you ask your next question.
I suppose that there's a lot of stuff in literature and the internet about the golden ratio, whether it's in plants or art. So what's true and what's unfounded?
Yeah, so I mentioned about the fact that, you know, one way to build a spiral structure is to put points on the helix at a given angle. So the French mathematicians and botanists that I mentioned of 1837 posited that this angle would indeed be the golden angle, which is related to the golden ratio, right? The golden angle cuts the circle in a golden ratio proportion. And so they said that because of their understanding of the relationship between the angle and the number of spirals that are visible, they proved that, and that was really a proof, and it became known eventually as the fundamental theorem of phyllotaxis. They proved that if you do you use the golden angle, then you will get a Fibonacci number of spirals. So they say, this is it. You know, this is a beautiful mathematical answer to the mystery of why Fibonacci. Just do the golden angle and you'll get Fibonacci spirals. However, you know, in simulations and models that we've been using, simple models, we see that this rule is broken again and again, and you can get Fibonacci phyllotaxis without sticking hard to the golden angle rule. As for the occurrence of the golden ratio in the art, this is a very controversial subject, and we tend, the authors in this book, tend to think that there's no such thing until the 20th century, and there was a kind of a media coup by a couple of authors in the 19th century that pushed that theory that everything was understandable by the golden ratio. So they started analyzing all kinds of art, the Parthenon, the, you know, the Da Vinci paintings and all that. And they imposed models of the golden ratio proportions. The problem with that is it was never precise, and it was never documented by the artists, including Leonardo da Vinci, who illustrated a book about the golden ratio, but never talks about it in his art. And there's absolutely no indication that he used the golden ratio in his art. Same thing with the Parthenon, you know, the way that people measured those proportions was usually, oh, how many steps in the stairway are you going to use to make your golden rectangle? So it's very dubious that indeed those artists, until the 20th century, used the golden ratio in their art. You know, so Le Corbusier, the architect, did explicitly use the Fibonacci numbers in his art, in his architecture, but that's documented.
I find that to be very interesting, because we look at something for the golden ratio and we think whether it's a face or a structure to be perfect. But having that not really brought up until more recent times, and applying that into whether it's plants or art or any sort of concept, makes you really reflect on what people think is beautiful. Or is the question of more, is beauty symmetry?
Yeah.
Or is it going to be something some people find, you know, an imperfection, or something completely asymmetric to be beautiful? So is it practicality? Is it application? It's kind of left a little bit open-ended with that. Now, it makes you really think about why people are also drawn to spirals. And when you're having something that's spiraling, you know, is that going to be perfectly symmetric? Is that going to have a lot of different applications? But for plants, why are people actually drawn to plant spirals? How does this topic pull such a wide range of people into the world of science and math?
Well, to me, I mean, personally, I find that plant spirals are just really beautiful. Like, if you look at the cover of our book, which has a spiraling fern, it's not a Fibonacci spiraling fern. It's a little bit tricky, but it is a very beautifully spiraling fern. It's a little bit hypnotic. I mean, looking at numbers, maybe that brings a kind of joy, but have you ever really stared at the center of a succulent or at the seeds of a sunflower? I personally think that plant spirals are a kind of gateway drug to math and science. I mean, in a way, that's how it worked for me. And that's also really one of the goals of our book, is to use these spirals to pull in readers who wouldn't normally pick up a science or a math book at the bookstore. Maybe they're gardeners, you know, maybe they have a very casual interest in patterns and design, but they might not pick up a book that introduces math and hard science without the hypnotic fern on the cover. And there are many beautiful photos in the book of plant patterns, but I think also sort of draw people into this, to our world. The spirals have also pulled in scientists from many different disciplines, which is kind of interesting. And that's why our book has three scientific co-authors, a physicist, a biologist, and Chris, our mathematician. And also, there's just something about this enduring mystery. I think it was nicely stated in one of the epigraphs at the beginning of our book by our biologist co-author, Jacques Dumay, who is a professor in Valparaiso, Chile. And he writes, "Phyllotaxis is so appealing. It seems accessible, like pi. So many people have tried to explain pi. And it's the same with phyllotaxis. Everybody goes out and says, I'm going to solve this riddle. And every 10 years, someone puts out a theory, and often it's a step backwards.
Or it's a spiral.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.
It's an aura spiral, exactly.
Right, like we toyed with this, model of historical model of the evolution of science as a spiral. Yeah, you kind of come back to the same place, but maybe you moved out a little bit. You moved up the understanding a little bit, but a lot of it is reinventing the wheel, and I plead totally guilty. You know what I think was one of my more important thought about phylotaxis. Somebody already had the germ of that idea more than 100 years ago, right? And so, but it's exciting to place yourself that way in the history of science. One example that might illustrate your question of why the fascination for plant spiral is the story of why Alan Turing got interested in it, right? He essentially he wanted to understand life. Yeah, pretty ambitious.
What is life?
But if you think about life, is you start with an undifferentiated body of cells, a few cells, and then suddenly they become differentiated and they create patterns. And how? Why? So he came up with this immensely popular now paper on morphogenesis and, positing the existence of two chemical components reacting with one another and forming out of uniformity, out of uniform distribution of the chemical, forming patterns, right? And he said, well, the uniform equilibrium is unstable. So that's called the Turing instability. But at the same time, he was trying to think about how to apply this model to phylotaxis, because he thought that phylotaxis was the simplest pattern formation you could think, right? It seems so repetitive and so simple that certainly there was a simple model that could explain it. So one of the first computer program he ever wrote on one of the first computers in the world was a program to model phylotaxis. And that's because it was a simple model of life as pattern formation.
Now, talk to us about phylotaxis. What is it on a higher level? There's two types, correct? Fibonacci type and quasi-symmetric. How can we tell the difference?
Yeah, so the quasi-symmetric, we talked about Fibonacci phylotaxis a bunch here. So what about this quasi-symmetric thing? So this is I should not say invention, but observation from our co-author, Stéphane Douady. It came out with our collaboration in the modeling that we were using. And I was saying, if you up the parameter, of this disk stacking model. And if you make the radius of the disk decrease too fast, then you don't get Fibonacci phyllotaxis anymore. And he said, so what do you get? And I said, well, you know, the number of spirals is not Fibonacci, but it's they tend to have the same number of spirals on either side. So it would be N and N, or N and N plus one, or N minus one and N, or N and N plus two, but the number of spirals were very close to one another. And he said, oh, this is what I've seen all these years in the corn. And so we started looking more at plants, and indeed corn doesn't do Fibonacci phyllotaxis. It does this pattern that we saw in those simulations. And so he called them quasi-symmetric, because those in the Fibonacci phyllotaxis, the spirals in one direction, in the directions with more of them, is going to be more vertical, are going to be more vertical, and the spirals in the other direction are going to be more flat. And so they're not symmetric. But if the number of spirals are about the same, then the slope of those spirals is going to be about the same. So that's where the word quasi-symmetric came from. And the more we go, the more we find these quasi-symmetric patterns, usually in inflorescences and fruits. So, you know, I did a study with students this summer where we picked strawberries and on the Smith campus, wild strawberries, and they're all quasi-symmetric. And we looked at Jack in the Pulpit. We looked at skunk cabbage and peace lilies. And all these are quasi-symmetric, the inflorescence. And so yes, we want to bring the attention to these other types of patterns that people essentially didn't recognize until recently.
Oh, exciting. Now, that brings the question of, is Fibonacci phyllotaxis optimizing something? Does that have an evolutionary advantage at all?
Yeah, so that's a controversial subject as well. So there are studies that show that, you know, there is a packing optimization that occurs if you do Fibonacci phyllotaxis, but other and with the golden angle, but other noble angles, so we're talking about number theory here, noble angles would be angles whose continued fraction expansion would be a long sequence of ones at the end. Those noble angles would give the same result. So why Fibonacci and not another angle? But nonetheless, there is some kind of packing advantage of the Fibonacci phyllotaxis. But contrary to the common thought, it's probably not to optimize light absorption, because that depends greatly on the shape of the leaf. And leaves are very good at, you know, plants are very good at turning their leaves towards the sun if need be. So why would they spend their energy in optimizing the leaf placement? Something that I believe is more promising as a hypothesis is the fact that all these structures are born at when inside a bud of a plant, when the pattern is very, very small. And if you want to optimize your energy in material production, you better do your pattern in the smallest area possible, so as to optimize material production. So that's something that speaks to me, at least. I'm a mathematician, right? I'm not a biologist. And also, some people have argued that maybe there's a mechanical advantage in having organs better spread out around the periphery.
There are a lot of self-repeating patterns in plants. Everyone, mm-hmm. The thing that I think about quite naturally is Romanesco broccoli. Everybody's familiar with it and how it repeats. So tell us a little bit about that. Is it infinite? You talk about materials packing. It reminds me of the coastline paradox as well, when you see that example of how it's multiplying.
Yes. Yeah, so as in the coastline, right? Yeah. It is a model of a fractal, which is not completely mathematical, right? Because in the model of fractals, the mathematical of fractals, you have, infinite jaggedness at any scale whatsoever, right? Yes. Of course, you cannot have that in nature because, you pretty soon go into subatomic scale, and then it doesn't make sense to talk about the jaggedness of that. But when people think about fractals, they often think about self-similarity. And we had this nice discussion in the book and outside as we were writing the book with our co-author, Stéphane Douady, the physicist, about what a fractal is and is the broccoli Romanesco a real fractal? And so, so I would argue no, because it does not have this infinite jaggedness in it. And more technically, it doesn't have the, Hausdorff dimension. That's not an integer. Nonetheless, the concept of fractal is striking at a broccoli Romanesco. And that's in fact how Stéphane got into this field, because he saw this broccoli Romanesco in a market in Paris, and he started looking at the fractal properties of it. And then he realized later on, oh, there are spirals too. But there is this self-similarity in the broccoli Romanesco is really captivating because it has seven generations so of self-similarity. So you take the whole flower, the whole broccoli, and then it's composed of many florets. So you look at those florets, and within those florets, there are baby florets. And then within those florets, there's other baby florets, and so on and so forth, all arranged in spirals. And we show, and Stéphane dissected one of those Romanesco broccolis, and he got to seven generation of cell similarity, which is pretty amazing. So there we go. They don't go to infinity, but they're strikingly fractal in a friendly sense of the term, of that cell similarity.
That's exciting to see. Now, when I was going through the book, there was a little bit of a tale from cell division. And you paralleled that to soap bubbles. Tell us the history of that here.
Yeah, so that was work by our colleague Jacques Dumais, the co-author biologist. And so one year he had accepted to take on a high school student, actually a local student from Northampton, and was the son of one of the botanical garden people. And he took him in his lab, and he was, looking for work for him to do. And he had the idea that there might be a connection. Well, there's somebody who had come up with the idea that cell divide according to very special rules. So they should divide in such a way that the new membrane that separate the cell in two should be perpendicular to the walls of the existing cell, and in such a way that the area that it divides the cell in are equal. So that guy is called Herrera from the 19th century, if I recall. And so Jacques started to have this high school student work on...
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Manipulating soap bubbles and pushing the little wall in between that separate the bubble with little instruments very delicately and pushing them around. And it discovered that, yes, there's an optimal solution for a given shape of a bubble, but there could be also, local minima or local optimum that also were semi-stable for the bubbles. And so he started then creating a mathematical model. Jacques and some postdocs created mathematical models of how to model cell division, and they found out a number of possible equilibria, and some of those equilibria are indeed seen in plants. So some are realized in nature and some are not. But some are definitely realized, and so it explained how nature actually does follow some kind of optimization rule for its cell divisions, and it creates a dynamical system that has stable equilibria, and so they were able to classify those stable equilibria, which is a really beautiful biomath kind of endeavor.
Wonderful. Out of curiosity, when I was flipping through at the end, a little Easter egg for anybody who hasn't read the book, there was a chapter on recipes. What inspired that?
Well, first of all, as you've noticed, Chris and Stéphane, the physicist, are French. And of course, food is a really important part of French culture. And I had spent 2 years living in France in my youth. And of course, that infected me for the rest of my life. And I think all four of us co-authors love to cook. Well, actually, I'm not sure about Jacques. Does Jacques like cooking?
But yeah, no, he's a good cook.
He's a good cook, see? Yeah. So the recipes were really another strategy for making the book accessible and fun for people who might not otherwise pick up a hard science book. And of course, they play off the content of the book. There's a recipe for sautéed Romanesco broccoli, which, as Chris mentioned, is the very plant that first inspired Stéphane the physicist to begin studying plant spirals. There's a recipe for red cabbage. Maybe this is a spoiler, but if you take a red cabbage and you slice it through the equator, you get these absolutely gorgeous spirals that you can see in both halves. And just the thought that a common cabbage, which is sort of like a lowly, not very exciting vegetable, would have these beautiful spirals at the core of it, for me, was very thrilling. And then there's a recipe for strawberry strudel, which is based on one from my great aunt Thelma, who lived to be 100. She was Hungarian, and she was an incredible baker. I modified the recipe from apples to strawberries because strawberry seeds show those quasi-symmetric properties that Chris talked about before. So it's a way to celebrate your journey through the book. If you get to the end, you know, we thought, this will be fun for people. And we actually hope that people will have a little Philotaxis feast and send us pictures from their dinners.
Now, with all of these recipes that have been in the book, I'm just thinking about Julia Child always cooking at Smith College, right? Mm-hmm. Are there any notable women in the field of plant math that may or may not be in the book? I have to say, as a woman in STEM, Chris, you work at Smith. It's one of the biggest institutions for women. Mm-hmm. Are there any notable women that do this sort of work that you're aware of?
Well, in the past, not enough, right? And in the present, a little bit more, and that's hopeful. But yes, there is a barrier to entry for women in math in particular, and Smith College, you know, fights that mightily. We created a Center for Women in Math with a post-bac program that has had a pretty big influence on how many women pursue their PhD and pursue mathematical careers henceforth. So in terms of, biomath or plant math, we could not find too many examples, unfortunately. One beautiful example is the sister of this German naturalist, Brown, Cecilia Brown, made all his illustrations, and they are absolutely gorgeous and very, very precise rendition of pine cones. And, with all their angle structures that had to be right, and she did a beautifully, at the same time, precise and artistic work there. There is also the example of a pair of husband and wife, the Snows, that have come up with some important hypotheses on how phyllotaxis happens. And in the more recent times, I personally worked with this woman called Siobhan Braybrook, and she's a developmental and mechanobiologist who is now at UCLA. And, she's great at integrating any science together. And so she's a firebrand. She's a great scientist and open to math, mechanics and physics, and of course, biology. There's also a rising star in Finland. Her name is Paula Eloma, who did a great amount of work on the phyllotaxis of Gerber daisies with a very integrated team of scientists from all sides of computer science, math, and physics. And so she's very good too.
Wonderful. Now, we've talked a little bit about highlighting stories about people who were less well known. Could you particularly pick one out, especially one that surprised you?
So here's where I was going to talk about Bonnet, that Chris stole my Bonnet story.
It's okay. It happens.
Okay. So maybe I'll just do my spiel and you can choose one.
Go
Hopefully
for it.
Mine.
No. Go for it. Okay. Was there anything in general that surprised you? How about that?
Well, my personal favorite character in the book is the Swiss scientist Charles Bonnet, who lived from 1720 to 1793. He faced a number of physical challenges, being deaf from an early age. He started out studying insects, and he discovered that butterflies breathe through tiny pores, which he named stigmata, sparicles, I think we call them now. But all those years of close observation under a microscope weakened his eyesight, and so he turned to plants instead, as they were larger and easier to observe. He became the first person to organize leaf arrangements into five neat categories, which was quite important. And he was also the first to mention the word spiral in relation to phyllotaxis. So he performed these early science experiments before the scientific method had even really been established. And from his observations, he believed that he had proved that plant leaves are different on the top than they are on the bottom because the leaf bottoms absorbed dew. The thing is, he thought that dew came up from the ground and not down from condensation in the air. And even if some of his conclusions seem a little silly today, he did truly groundbreaking research on plant respiration, which led to our modern understanding of how plants breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. Bonnet was also the first to describe what is today known as Bonnet syndrome, the visual hallucinations that are caused by the brain when it's struggling to adjust to vision loss. He observed this phenomenon in his grandfather, who had cataracts. These are visual hallucinations caused by the brain struggling to adjust to serious vision loss. He observed this phenomenon in his grandfather, who had cataracts, a man who was perfectly level-headed, but who saw strange images of birds, carriages, and buildings rising up before his eyes in all their details, seemingly very real. And Oliver Sacks wrote about Bonnet syndrome in his book, Hallucinations.
Wonderful. Now, out of curiosity, do you have any recommendations for further readings or resources for listeners who want to delve deeper into plant math and history?
So, of course, our book.
Yes, there's really nothing like it out there.
There is, for the more mathematical minded, there's somebody in England who studied very much Turing and his influence on phyllotaxis. He rediscovered the papers on phyllotaxis, interpreted them, and made them known. And he had this wonderful citizen science experiment where he had people counting spirals on sunflowers. He's come up, he teaches a course on phyllotaxis at Oxford, I think, or Cambridge, I can't remember, Oxford, I believe. And he came up with a book, and I can't remember if it's out yet, but the book exists, and I would recommend it very much. So his name is Jonathan Swinton. He wrote a beautiful book about Turing in Manchester, at any rate, which I would recommend greatly.
Alan Turing's Manchester. Yeah.
Yes.
And then for me, there are two very well-known popular science writers who both had books that were helpful for me when I was first getting into this topic. Ian Stewart wrote The Beauty of Numbers in Nature, a classic. And another classic is Philip Ball's Patterns in Nature. There's a more academic version, and then there's a more popular version, but they both have beautiful pictures as well. And very beautiful science writing, just really a model and an inspiration. And I'm currently reading a new book about botany. It's not plant spirals, but it's a lot of fun. It's called The Light Eaters, and it's by an author named Zoe Schlanger.
Wonderful. To wrap things up for today, is there anything that you want folks to take away or that we haven't covered?
I would say, like Charles Bonnet himself does in the beginning of his book, is look around, walk in nature, look at nature. You know, she will teach you everything you need to know.
Well, I would just say that it has been a real privilege for me to be with people who do exactly that on a kind of extraordinary level. You know, it's just a tremendous amount of fun to be with scientists as they are observing in the field. And I now have a microscope at home, so I'm constantly taking things out of my garden and looking at them in detail in a way that I never would have before. I find it really very thrilling to see the patterns in nature. I think they're a real source of joy.
Wonderful. I thank you both for coming on Breaking Math Podcast. And for listeners, if you're interested in getting the book, Do Plants Know Math? It is on sale in the United States on September 24th, 2024.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.